This is a farmer-led podcast, the Farm's Voice podcast. So thank you for tuning in. For those that farm it, service it, or just outright love it, we bring you the techniques and technologies you need to motivate and implement into your day to improve it one way or another. Make sure you share the Farm's Voice to make another farmer's day. Let's get into this episode.
Will Barton, g'day and welcome to the Farm's Voice podcast. Great to have you on. Another lamb enthusiast down there in the south around Gundagai. How's everything going?
Yeah, really well. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to having a yarn with you.
Hey, mate, it's a pleasure is mine. I've seen the work that you and the team have been doing and it's looking pretty great down there and what you're trying to achieve. Go in a new, take your own sort of path into what you want to build your agribusiness in, which is what we find pretty cool on the podcast as well. People doing something different.
Yeah. So my journey, I guess, I've lived in and around the business, which is an abattoir. When I was a kid, we sort of processed beef and lamb. And I spent, you know, holidays and every spare moment probably hanging around here and as I got older and what have you. And then I studied food science when I left school at CSU in Wagga, which I enjoyed. But then I kind of took a different path and I ended up studying property valuation at RMIT in Melbourne. And what that kind of led me into was the world of the valuation of like post-farm gate processing assets. So I was doing like almond hulling facilities and walnut cracking plants,
yep,
wineries, abattoirs. We valued things like, oyster sheds that were relying on different oyster leases. And I kind of unconsciously started to learn how different industries approach their supply chains. And that was really fascinating to me because one of the things I'm most passionate about now in this role, which I came to in 2014, is trying to reimagine the supply chain and trying to figure out how we could do the producer-processor relationship better.
Welcome to today's episode as we speak with the CEO of Gundagai Lamb, Will Barton. He's upbeat and passionate about improving his operations, but also the producers that supply the lamb. Through making these relationships, farmers can go home knowing that they can improve on for the benefits of the consumers, Gundagai Lamb as a processor, but also to return home as a farmer full of knowledge. So let's get into this episode with Will.
So Will, talk to us a little bit about your background and connection to agriculture. You've done some previous work outside, obviously, of meat processing. But how has that helped you along your way to your role now?
So I guess the experience that I had in property valuation, looking at lots of different businesses, particularly post-farm gate processing assets and how they interacted with farmers, how they interacted with the producers, how they fed information to them on quality and different elements like that, really started to form a lot of the ideas that I have about how to make sure that we're doing a better job of interacting with our producers, because ultimately if we don't have those producers, then we don't have the ability to execute our business plan, which is really about processing lambs for domestic and export markets.
Yeah, great stuff. And like previously you talked about trying to improve the supply chain. Is that improving it by shortening how many hands really touch the product along the way?
I think for us it's a bit more about, and I think it's really obvious but often overlooked, that as a processor, we're kind of in the middle of the sandwich that's between kind of the producer and the consumer, right? And I sort of think about us as that tight spot in an hourglass where you might have, you know, hundreds of producers that are supplying one meat processing facility that are then supplying hundreds of consumers, thousands of consumers indirectly. And so for us, it's more about making sure that we're listening to what the consumer wants and that we're telling the producer what that is. So the whole kind of, I guess, ethos of this business as it relates to our own lamb brand, Gundagai Lamb, is to, one, make sure we tell producers in as much detail as we can what it was that they sent us.
Yep.
So all the objective data we can, and then as a sort of a part two, to tell them exactly what we want them to send us. And the most obvious way to do that is with pricing. So to tell someone, I'll pay you more if you send me something like this.
Yeah, definitely. And supply chains can be quite diverse. Last week we had Noel Answorth talking about fresh food supply chains. And I imagine how vastly different it is to working with lamb. Meat processing can be quite different than what our other sectors of agriculture are doing as well. So for yourself, how does it all work on your supply chain? Talk us through it from start to finish.
So we've done some different things. I'll give you an overview of how the actual supply chain itself works and then what we're doing in our brand. So essentially lambs are delivered on a Sunday afternoon, for instance. We process them on day one. They're chilled overnight as carcasses. They're boned out in our boning room on day two. Chilled again in a carton on that evening. And on day three, they're really ready for dispatch. You don't want them too fresh going into markets. They need a certain number of days, you know, aging in the bag. And so that's typically sort of 5 to 7 days before we want people to be using the product in markets. The real difference about our business and our brand, Gundigo Lamb, is that we've got a range of new technologies. I'll try to explain them to you without nerding out too much and losing your listeners. But so if you think about lamb for, you know, 50 years, really the only thing you knew when you were buying a leg of lamb or a rack of lamb or anything else is that it would probably be between 6 and 12 months of age, and it would probably have come from a carcass that weighs, you know, somewhere between 20 and, you know, 26 kilos, much lighter, you know, a couple of decades ago and sort of heavier today. And we didn't really have any measure like that in beef of how much marbling it had, which is intramuscular fat or other traits. It was really just weight. What we've got here is the ability to measure the lean meat yield of the carcass. So we had the first hot DEXA unit in Australia and probably the world in lamb processing, which means that for every carcass we process, we understand how much meat, fat, and bone is in that carcass. And that helps us share the information with farmers so that they're not over-fattening lamb, because there's a lot more energy required to lay a fat on a lamb than there is to grow the meat. And there is a certain point at which it becomes wasteful. So there's a sustainability element there for us to help a producer really understand in with good accuracy, so really objectively, what the lean meat yield content is. The main risk, though, with telling a farmer that information and getting them to optimise for yield is that if they don't have a sort of an eye out for quality, you can breed out quality and namely intramuscular fat. So we've also, another first for us, we've got the MEQ probe here, which measures intramuscular fat, and it's now been Ausmed approved. And so for every carcass, we not only know its lean meat yield, but we also know the level of intramuscular fat. And it is the single most important element in the eating quality outcome of a lamb. So we've got those two pieces of information, which are hugely powerful and don't exist anywhere else yet, although I imagine they'll be really common in the next year or two across the lamb processing space. Then the third element we've got is animal health. So we record about 20 animal health conditions by carcass. So, you know, years gone by, you'd have arthritis in a lamb, and so a hind leg would have to be chopped off, or you'd have pleurisy in a lamb that would mean its rib cage was removed, and a producer would send something to a meat processor. They'd expect that the lambs all would weigh between, you know, 24 and 28 kilos because they weighed them all on farm, and then they'd get one back that weighed 19, and then they'd cry foul. Clearly something funny happened with the scales and the meat processing plant. And it was all part of this mistrust that existed, whereas we can tell a producer that lamb that weighed 19 kilos also had arthritis. And so then they can draw a line that, well, it's more than likely that it's lost a limb or two that's created that reduction in weight. So for us, the business is really about providing as much information as we can to a producer to help them get better, which helps us to deliver the right quality and consistent quality to the consumer, but helps them be more profitable because we're able to pay them more because we know that they're sending us what we want. And every year they get better on that basis.
Yeah, definitely. I see, like, us as lamb producers as well, being fed some information on how we can improve, reduce the fat, increase the fat, or get that yield up a little bit higher. how are you actually feeding back the information? Is it literally via email, or how do you do that for the farmers?
So we've still got like the traditional feedback form, which is, you know, the weight and fat score grid, which is pretty simple, hasn't changed for a number of decades, everyone's pretty familiar with. We also send an Excel spreadsheet, which has a line for every carcass. So it's got its RFID, any animal health conditions it had, weight, lean meat yield, intramuscular fat, et cetera. But we've also got an app. So we've got a producer portal, which producers can log into. It's usually about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon on the day of slaughter. And it gives the producer all of that information, but in really dynamic kind of visual graphs. It plots all of their data against our averages. So when they look at their intramuscular fat distribution, for instance, it'll also tell them what the common Gundagai lamb distribution looks like. And then the other thing it does is it gives them benchmarking. So it tells them what quartile they're in, you know, all of our producers. So you've got this, not that I'm discouraging anyone from going to the local pub or from having a conversation, you know, with different people in their sphere of influence, but they immediately get feedback on how their intramuscular fat levels compared to everybody else that's supplying us the lean meat yield. Yep. And we've got this sort of unique quality score called the GLQ score, which pulls that all together into one carcass scoring metric. And so they can also see on our scoring system where they sit relative to their peers, which is really important to get that feedback kind of in a timely way.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. And nothing like a neighbour trying to spur you on to improve your yield to beat his crop out of it as well.
That's right.
How have you seen the response from farmers? Have you literally seen it in the products that have come through? You've seen like one farmer's change their approach in the last 5 years? That sort of...
Well, because we haven't been going for very long, we've really only... We started in 2020 and really for the first 12 months, we were sort of doing trials and small volumes. We've really been at it, you know, week in, week out since probably June last year. And so we haven't seen that change, you know, generational change yet. What we have seen is a profound change in the attitude of those producers and the way that they look at ram selection, in the way that they're, you know, considering how to balance weight, you know, growth rates, lean meat yield outcomes, and making sure that they don't forget intramuscular fat, because they can see that as a risk if they don't have it, that in future they'll have an inferior product. And so in a lot of respects, it's as simple as, hey, pay attention to this. This is going to become more and more important in the future. For now, we're just using the grading system to sort the good everyday Australian lamb from the really good high quality stuff.
Yep.
But over time, we'll get more and more specific about that and start targeting the farmers that are sending us the really, really good stuff all the time.
Yeah, and the longer time you've been in operation, the better trends you'll start to see, and especially for the farmers as well, they'll get even better feedback on the back of it.
What's the most obvious question that we get asked every single time is, what's the best breed? And like, which one's giving you the best outcomes? And it's really interesting internally, because there's so many little influences that impact whether or not you're going to get, you know, the right lean meat yield or intramuscular fat outcome. And look, breed's part of it, but it's actually really more genetics. So, and anyone in the space that spent a lot of time in it and looked really hard at genetics knows that there's really more variation between one breed and another, inside a breed, than there is between one breed and another. So what we find is that we've got some producers that are sort of discovering that the years that they've been putting into intramuscular fat development are paying off, because now they're getting a measure of it. And we pay a bonus of 50 cents a kilo for any lamb that's got greater than 5% intramuscular fat. So those producers are really getting rewarded for that now. And then we find other producers that haven't paid any attention to it, and they've just fluked it, and their genetics that they've been using for generations is naturally high in IMF, and so they're doing well. And so we haven't really seen clear trends about one breed versus another, but we are seeing trends about one producer or one set of genetics that are better than others. And we're building that database so that we can sort of become more robust in our thinking, you know, around whether that's a fluke or a trend, or, you know, what that looks like. The other one is feed. So a lot of people are focused on, you know, how important is feed and how important is maturity, and those things all play a role. one of the things that we went into spring last year was we were worried, is all the intramuscular fat going to disappear when we start to get into sucker lambs because they're not mature, they haven't been around enough to develop intramuscular fat. And the reality is that we probably lost maybe, you know, 0.5% on average in intramuscular fat, but we still had suckers that were performing extremely well in intramuscular fat, and we still had lambs that were performing really badly, and we still had lots in the middle. And so the learning from that is that, yes, on average, a lamb when it's born has less intramuscular fat than it does at maturity, and that makes sense. But it doesn't mean that there isn't genetics that will deliver a high IMF lamb straight off the ewe as a sucker. So there's all these little things that we're learning along the way, which are really interesting.
Yeah, and it's all those sort of 1%ers. Everyone speaks about 1%ers, but you've also got yours there as a processor. How those 1%ers can impact you, but also the producers that bring in the lamb for you to process as well.
Yeah, and we this is really the beginning of what we're trying to do. So we've got these really simple measures, but we hope that in the next few months we'll also have primal yield measurement, so we'll be able to provide feedback on confirmation. So the ability to say this had the right lean profile, the right IMF profile. And, you know, some people would say, well, it's all well and good to have, you know, eating quality and yield, but what if the loin and the rack are really tiny and they've got big legs and, you know, shoulders? And so we'll be in a position very soon where, and we've been working on, you know, a way to get our technology to measure primal yields. And once that's in place, then we'll set a metric around rewarding, you know, higher proportions of rack and loin primal yields as a proportion of total weight, and probably penalising on the other end, you know, lambs that are coming through that have got small proportions there, where a lot of the value is for us. And that's one of those 1%ers for us as a processor, is making sure that when we buy a whole carcass, it's got the right amount of meat in the right areas to maximise our profitability.
Yeah, definitely. And like just before, you said you started in 2020. What month?
So I think we started... We'd been talking about it through 2019, and we had a bit of a crack at it sort of through February, March 2020. Yep. And we did some trials, and I looked back with my team. Some of the guys that are working the team have only been with us for sort of 6 or 9 months, and I showed them some of the early grid ideas that we had for pricing grids, and they're pretty out there, and they look pretty silly now when we look back on them, because we had some crazy ideas in 2020 when we sort of really got into it last year in mid-21. We'd refined it down to a 5x5 grid. So we've got 5 weight ranges and we've got 5 lean meat yield brackets, if you like, or boxes. And then there's 25 price points on the grid with a bonus for intramuscular fat in any of those categories. And we've certainly, come a long way since we started, for sure.
I bet. So in 2020, what was going on across the world? What spurred you on to unleash GMP?
Well, I think so. To the business GMP has been around for, you know, nearly 50 years. So we're a couple of years away from a 50-year anniversary, and we've spent most of the 2000s and the 2010s as a fee for service only plant. So we just did contract processing for clients, and really the reason we got into the tech and the reason that we sort of have evolved this brand Gundagai lamb into something in the last couple of years is that we had obviously a drought period where, you know, typically the livestock prices would reduce through a drought, but what we saw was the rise of the China market, and that had a really strong influence on keeping those protein prices and those livestock prices high, particularly in lamb. And we don't have China market access. So because of that. That's great.
Off randomly.
Yeah, right.
There we go, it's off now.
No worries. So because we didn't have that China market access, we really needed to look at ways to overcome that competitive disadvantage by not having market access and find new ways to create value in the supply chain. And that really led us to kind of stare into what the things were that the consumer needed. How to make the producer-processor relationship, well, how to build trust, but how to make it more efficient. So to give really good feedback to a land producer about what it is that we wanted, and importantly, what it is that we'd be willing to pay more for. Because that queue hasn't existed in lamb production systems for a long, long time. Like there's more, it almost, if you look at any agricultural commodity, there's a quality measure that allows a producer to get paid more, whether it's protein level, whether it's milk solids, whether it's microns. There's always a measure that says if you give us this, we'll pay you more. Beef the same. Lamb just hasn't had it. And so we thought if we were going to overcome some of those market access limitations that our business had, then we needed to sort of get cracking on, you know, really trying to redefine what that looked like. And that's what we tried to do with the Gunning Guy Lamb brand. And we're kind of in our infancy, but we're chipping away at it. And I think, you know, we're building the right momentum.
Yeah, definitely. And pushing in, I think, like, as consumers, like, changing tastes out there, and we're all wanting quality meat, red meat especially, for that, and just sort of bolsters what you're doing at Gundagai Lamb there, and how you're improving the whole process, not just what you're doing with your own supply chain, trying to
improve
farms as well.
And I think the one of lamb's big challenges from a consumer point of view is that it's become very expensive.
Yep.
So, you know, you've got a product that's pricing itself incredibly high in terms of where it sits relative to other proteins, and it's challenged by, in some markets, that price point. And if you're able to put an objective quality claim behind it, or an objective measurement of quality to then convince a purchaser that that's worth spending their money on because it's going to perform in a certain way, that becomes much easier for the product as a, you know, for that category, say, in a marketplace. But when you've got a high price protein like lamb in a marketplace, and you've got randomly some are better than others because of objective attributes that the industry's not measuring, then that becomes a real challenge for the market, because what you're relying on is the age of the animal, which is don't get me wrong, it's been a very successful, you know, quality gatekeeper for the last 50 years, is that it's lamb, not mutton. So that in and of itself works well. But now that we've got technology to go a step further, if you're really trying to command those high prices for the product, you've sort of got to be able to justify that it's going to, you know, perform the way that you'd like it to perform when it gets to market, and not disappoint a consumer. Because in some markets that are emerging, like the US, for instance, they went off lamb, you know, for their sheep population's been in decline. I think there's more lambs in the Riverina than there are in the whole of the United States.
You're right.
Yeah. So you've got this whole nation that's kind of turned their back on sheep meat and lamb historically, and they're being re-educated. So they're starting, in the last few years, they've really started to eat a lot more lamb, which is great news for the Australian market, and really well covered by, you know, market analysis that you get through the MLA and Mercado and others like that. The challenge you have, though, is if you're getting a generation of people that are light bulbs going on, maybe we should eat lamb, they have a bad experience. You might only have one shot at that consumer. So if you're trying to build momentum and you've got the ability to objectively measure quality and you can set the expectation right, and then you can meet that expectation, that's really powerful. And so that's different in a way to say if you're putting meat into the Middle East, where they're really, really familiar with how to cook lamb. They know sheep meat, they know lamb, they know how to cook it, how to prepare it. Their expectation around how it's going to perform and how to cook it in a way that will almost guarantee that it performs the way that they'd like it to via different cooking methods. That means that there's much less risk in certain elements there. Whereas if you're in a new market trying to charge a lot of money, then you want to make sure you get it right. And that's really what we're trying to focus on with the Gundagai Lamb brand, is this ability to be able to say to a chef or a consumer that will eat well, and not just because it looked good hanging on a rail in a carcass chiller, but because we measured it.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting, and it's pretty interesting. Like, I always see a lot of more marketing swung towards beef and that industry, and I see that, like, as a lamb producer, I feel that lamb is lacking in trying to educate and get onto the plates of consumers, because I think like people sit down and they just picture a steak rather than a lamb steak or a lamb chop. They just want easy eating, and they've grown up with steaks, beef steak. So I reckon there's a lot of work to be doing, and for you as a processor, you're doing a lot of that work as well, just to keep it relevant and also chase different lines and improving the quality. There's a lot that can be done for consumers to be able to uptake the lamb as a red meat.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to the expectation of that consumer. Like, a lot of people are daunted by lamb. They find that it's going to be, you know, something that maybe requires a lot of effort or a lot of time, or they're not sure how to cook it. And in part, I think that comes from the variability in eating quality that exists in those lamb cuts. So if you go out and you pay a lot of money for a leg, and for whatever reason it doesn't eat as well as you think it might, you're most likely to blame yourself or your cooking methodology, or that you're not a good enough, you know, home chef or whatever that is, rather than know that I bought a good one or a bad one, because all legs are the same. So if you transfer that into a situation where you set the expectation for a consumer that they're buying something that's either the best or not the best, and then they approach cooking it accordingly. So they say, I know, like if you go to beef and you buy a cheaper cut, you know, having bought that cheaper cut, that there are certain things that you might do in terms of your cooking method, or whether you marinate it overnight and slow cook it, or whether you know, chuck it on a barbecue, and you adjust your methodology based on the quality of the cut that you've purchased. And that's helped beef enormously over the last 20 or 30 years with MSA, because people, it's very hard to get a bad steak at an Australian pub or restaurant, because we've got, you know, supermarkets. Everything's improved dramatically because of MSA grading and that ability to see these traits and measure them. And so I think that's what's exciting about lamb, is that it helps people that are rediscovering lamb have more consistent experiences, so that they're not sort of set up to fail, or they've paid a lot of money and then feel they haven't got what they paid for, which is, I guess, a big part of what we're trying to do, is really get people back into lamb and know what they're doing and become more familiar. What's been really interesting, Jack, is that the point about there doesn't seem like there's as much energy in lamb as there is in beef, or those kinds of things. We haven't, as a business, been involved in buying livestock and selling meat. We sort of had a 20-year break where we were just exclusively the fee-for-service processor. So we didn't have, we weren't buying our own livestock, we weren't selling our own meat, and we've only really been back into it with Gundagai lamb for a year or two. And what's been interesting about that journey is really retesting some of the things that are commonplace. Like, all heavy lambs are exported. Why? Is it because the consumer's worried about them being too fat? We can measure fat. We can ensure they don't have too much fat because we've got this DEXA machine. And so there's lots of things that you can retest once you can see objectively what they look like, because you've gone from being, so you test a lot of old paradigms and re-involve yourself in those things, which is really, I find it really interesting. And I think we've got a lot of catching up to do in lamb on other market sectors. The people like the MLA have just as much information about markets in beef as they do lamb. They've got a similar level of consumer taste testing. So they've got most of the same modelling in those markets, and they're an amazing resource globally, the MLA, for information about trends and what have you. What's been lacking is the ability to objectively measure the traits that then feed into an MSA model, or feed into, well, this particular cut with this quality is going to play better in, you know, the EU or the US or Southeast Asia or the Middle East. And so what's really happening now is that as those things come together, they're really quickly making it easy to capitalize on a lot of MLA research and insights, a lot of research in consumer taste testing with the MSA. Now that objective measurement's catching up, we're we're on a really accelerated path towards improvement, in my view, really revolutionising the lamb supply chain as we've known it historically.
Yeah, both for domestic and like international export.
Yeah, for sure. Yep, definitely. Most definitely. They're two very different markets, and we've been, you know, growing our reliance on export markets. I think COVID's probably helped a lot of us refocus locally or readjust the balance a little bit. But there's certainly opportunity in both spaces, particularly because it's not a protein that's sort of overused or oversubscribed or saturated. Like, so it's not the sort of thing you see on a menu and you think, oh, I'm sick of seeing so many lamb options. It's one of those things that's got a lot of scope for growth if you can approach it right. And so, yeah, I think domestic and export, there's lots of opportunities in both for sure. Yep.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's like an exciting space. It's not actually like a product. It's not like buying an Apple iPhone, but it's a lamb that everyone's trying to improve and you're trying to get that onto consumers' plates, like in mass type of thing. So it's pretty exciting to see how slight tweaks to what's going on, like the MSA, the data that you get back from yourself as a processor and also for the farmers, how those slight tweaks can actually improve the how the consumers receive it on their end.
You're taking something, and we find this with producers who have been looking at this stuff for a long time. They've come from, you know, like let's say you've got a stud breeder who's also got a commercial flock, and they're really interested in the data and they've been working hard to select sires and genetics and different things and improve their lean meat yield. They've got an eye for intramuscular fat, mating quality and shear force and all of these metrics. And those businesses have historically, to get the data, they've had to do trials. And so they participate in like Nucleus flock trials with Meat and Livestock Australia, and they've had to do sort of expensive and time-consuming trials to get the data. Whereas now it's just become, certainly in the Gundagai lamb supply chain, it's just default data. So it's gone from being something that's relatively inaccessible, that needed to go through a lab and, you know, had costs involved and you had to participate in programs, all of which are still relevant, but now it's sort of something that's just for every man. So every producer that sends something to us has the ability to improve her or his flock and then come back next year and see the results. So that's another thing that's going to be really interesting, is for the people that have paid a lot of attention in the last 9 months and maybe made some different decisions on farm, for them to come back next year and say, oh, I've noticed that, or oh, that didn't make as big a difference as I thought it would, or that, you know, that those decisions that I've made historically have been vindicated or not. And so the ability to get information to actually make decisions and then see what you're doing, because if you're cropping, you can almost immediately tell the difference. Seasonal variations aside,
yeah,
a new variety, a new fertilizer rate, a new planting rate, a new air seeder, all these things with all the mapping, yield mapping, and all those different things, you can kind of get almost real-time feedback. Now, again, interrupted by seasons, and you say, oh, if I think they've had a bit more rain, then maybe that would have done this or that or the other. But we haven't had that in lamb. We've just said, get it to the weight before it breaks its teeth, send it to market, job done. And so that dynamic shift, I think, will help, particularly the producers that really want to get better. They'll get the data, get better. The consumer will say, can you keep sending me that stuff because it's great? And then value increases everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so true though. Like croppers don't know, broadacre don't know how good they have it when they want to improve something drastically. Livestock, generally, you've got only one chance a year to improve, as well as croppers as well. But for that, you're probably going to see the impact in 5 years if you're trying to chase some other trait that's going to improve your eating quality.
That's right. That's right. And so the reliance on, which is real across the entire ag space, but the reliance on, you know, long-term R&D and funding for those things and nucleus flock trials that help continually, I guess, measure what's happening and what genetic developments and improvements are working, and what breeds are doing better than others, all that, what lines in breeds are doing particularly well. That becomes really important. And also putting the bulk data behind it, then at our level, just really bolsters all of that. It takes it from pilot level data, from little trials that are done, that we're trying to scale up to make them representative of something.
Yep.
They don't have to do that anymore. They're now going to be accompanied by huge data sets that allow people to say, well, that worked or that didn't. And the other thing I think that's really interesting about it is that when we started thinking about it, we thought everything was going to be about high IMF and the opportunity created by like really high marbled product. So think like Wagyu or, you know, some sort of really high-end product. And that was sort of really my early thinking through 2019 and 20 was really focused on, you know, the idea that we might find this super high marbling kind of outcome. And that's really evolved a lot because now we think more about IMF, low IMF as a risk rather than seeing high IMF as this huge opportunity. And so now we kind of think, well, we've just got to really make sure we avoid low IMF because, or not avoid it, but really start to breed it out over time.
Yeah.
So that we can continue to receive the high prices that we do for high quality lamb as a category and therefore continue to, you know, pay farmers well for what they're producing. So there's been lots of little evolutions like that where we change our thinking. You know, we're very curious. We don't have anywhere near all the answers. We've got more questions than answers, and it's good fun really actually to be part of it because every day is a new day where we sort of get curious about things and go down rabbit holes and, you know, test old, I guess, old ways of working and say, can we do that better? And why do we do it that way? Is that, you know, what's that about? Can we measure that differently? And I think that's a really good message to be sending back to particularly younger, well, to farmers that have been at it for a while.
Yep.
We're going to start recognising those efforts. For younger people thinking about it, the amount of opportunities now in businesses like ours to work on these things, either in a processing plant, on farm, advising farmers, all those things creates lots of opportunity in an industry that once was get it to weight quickly with the appropriate amount of condition and make sure you do it before it breaks its teeth. Yeah.
There's a lot going on, and it's as it should be that you're staying curious and always asking questions, why this, why that. It's always good to challenge the older blokes if dad's listening. It's important, but also, like as you said before, you can't just drop it straight off. You have to sort of taper off on those traits as well. Otherwise, you may see some impact somewhere else.
Look, that's
so as a business as well.
That's been the really pleasing thing about, and look, we focus so hard in our partnership with MEQ Probe, who measure our intramuscular fat level. You know, Adexa, the lean meat yield management tool, had a long lead time, and it took a lot to commission and get it into the plant and get it working. And there was this fear that grew as we got closer and closer to commissioning the DEXA unit that we would be able to send signals to producers about their lean meat yield, but we wouldn't have a measure of intramuscular fat. And that fear was that if we, and it required a bit of restraint really, because we make more money as a processor out of higher yielding products, full stop. We buy a carcass for the whole carcass, and the more fat it has on it, the more fat that ends up on the burning room floor and the less meat that ends up in the box. So on simple kind of maths or logic, the leaner it is, the more money we make. But there is a tipping point if it's not finished or it's not accompanied by intramuscular fat, that it won't taste at all. Like it will taste bad. So once DEXA got close, we started to get nervous and like we really need to crack eating quality. We really need to crack intramuscular fat so that we can give farmers both, because chasing one in isolation is quite dangerous. If you create a really high lean meat yield carcass that's got no intramuscular fat, bad outcome for the person eating it, right? It's not going to eat well. If you chase intramuscular fat and you do it by lot feeding something for 200 days, and and you don't pay attention to lean meat, then you could create the most beautifully marbled eye muscle that you've ever seen in your life. But if it's got 40 mil of fat cover, it's not much good to us either, because we're paying for all this stuff that we're going to trim off. So that balance is something that's going to be a huge challenge for producers in the next 5 to 10 years, for people to really nail that. And we're really getting a lot of interest from people that really want to nail that combo. And so, yeah, that's exciting to be around as well.
It definitely, for the lamb that comes in, feed lotting and grass fed, what's the split on that, do you know?
Certainly this season, overwhelmingly grass fed.
Yep.
And I think that is a seasonal dynamic. Plenty of grass around this year, plenty of rain. And so that's an overwhelming kind of stat that it's mostly grass fed. Obviously there's a bit of finishing going on in the grain fed space. I think the market in lamb certainly still favours a grass fed production system. Beef, you know, people are probably a little bit more used to grain feeding or grain finishing, and the US market, for instance, is they like to feed just about everything in their production system in lamb. It's all grain fed, but it's sort of still something we're trying to navigate our way through, just how practical it is through different seasons to have a brand that's exclusively or even just a brand channel within the brand sort of architecture that has a grass-fed claim, because I think it's ideal from a consumer point of view, but it's not necessarily practical from a production point of view. And I also wonder whether the market might be more accepting of a grain-fed product if they knew that it was grain-fed to an appropriate amount of fat with the appropriate amount of animal health measurement in place. So, you know, you rethink that and you think, why is a consumer, you know, not a big fan of grain? Is it the confinement? Is it that they think it's an adverse animal health outcome? Is it that they're concerned about, you know, an over-fattened animal? And so if you can address a few of those things by saying, well, actually, we measure those things and we make sure they're not out of step, then you might be in a situation where it becomes less important. But that will absolutely be driven by the consumer. And the producer, with our help, will have to try to figure out how to deliver to whatever that expectation is.
It just comes back to the work that has to be done for lamb to be up. Would you say it's the top three proteins within Australia, lamb?
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. Certainly by value on a per kilo basis, it is. And we're in a flock rebuild mode. So, you know, on that basis, it's certainly up there. But, yeah, I don't really know how it would compare on the other metrics by which you might measure it. I think it's still, certainly for our region, still a go-to part of a mixed enterprise. And we're really conscious, particularly in mixed farming areas, that people really have the opportunity to, you know, put grapes on the side of a hill, run cattle, run sheep, crop. There's a lot of different enterprises that you can go to. And I think to encourage people to make a decision to go into lamb, they need to see businesses that are committed to setting the space up for future success. They need to see someone that's saying, righto, we're going to change this. We're going to give you better feedback. We're going to help you make you profitable because it's in our interests and your interests. And that confidence is really important so that we don't find ourselves, you know, with a region that's sort of gone really heavy into cattle, really heavy into cropping. So we've got to, I guess, in some senses, fight to demonstrate that lamb's a really valid choice. And you know, I think we're doing that at the moment, but through seasons, through, you know, good times and bad times, through market cycles, through the Aussie dollar cycles, all those things, we've got to keep making sure that we're standing up and saying this is a good choice, because, you know, land is finite, uses are developing, you know, yields are improving, whether it's red meat production or cropping, everything else is getting better. So if you don't keep pace with that, farmers will just move to what best suits their land, but what also they can sustain a family on and drive profit with. So we've got to make sure that we're making it clear to producers how they can be profitable with land, to make sure we're still relevant.
Yeah, that's it. I think we might have to reach out to Sam Kekovic. Yeah, that 364 days of the year to see improve lamb. He does a stellar job for the one day and the week leading up to it, but I think there's a lot of work to be done outside of Australia Day.
Yeah, that's for sure. And that's just another dynamic of lamb. It's become something that people eat either, you know, for a special occasion rather than the regular Sunday roast that we grew up with. So, you know, all those things provide challenges and they're all welcome challenges, because I think if you really want to be successful, you've got to have a go at solving some of those market perceptions by trying to innovate and change the way that you're approaching it.
Yeah, definitely.
Which for us is that quality piece here.
Yeah, we'll probably have to start selling loin chops through Uber Eats just to get consumers thinking about lamb again.
That's it. I'm not sure what the wait time would be on a lamb chop from Uber Eats in Gundagai or south of Dubbo, but I don't know that it'd come very quickly.
Yeah, I won't hold my breath. But, mate, a stat I pulled off the website, pull me up if it's wrong, you process 1 million animals a year?
Yeah, broadly, that's our production capacity, yep.
You've got 250 employees?
Yes.
So that's 4,000 animals processed per employee. I did some quick math before the show.
Yeah. Yep.
That's pretty good.
That makes sense. Yeah, because across a year, we're obviously facing, like everybody in agriculture, and I think basically everybody in Australia, extreme challenges around labour. So this year we won't process that many, and that's a concern for us, because we're in a year where we've got more lambs than we've had for a while to process and less capacity to do that. And that's a real challenge for the brand too, as we're growing and we're getting people interested. We're finding ourselves often really oversubscribed for the for the grids that we're putting out. But, you know, we're welcoming the fact that, you know, in the last few days that the borders have opened up and we're starting to get a few backpackers for you through and different things that'll, you know, help man all sorts of different tasks in the ag space and particularly in our business, so that we can get back to that kind of productivity level that you see on the website.
Yeah, but like all good things take time. So take it steady. And the way you're running it, the way you've come across on the podcast today, it's pretty exciting to have you at the helm of Gundagai Lamb, but also having input in the broader aspect of what Australian lamb is.
Thanks, Jack. Yeah, appreciate that.
So let's keep lamb the top of conversation right across Australia. But before you go for this episode, who is someone else that you'd like to hear on the Farms Advice podcast?
Look, I think there's lots of people out there that are interesting. Probably the person that I found most interesting, and it's just part of where I've been in my kind of journey with the brand over the last 6 months, is a lady by the name of Heidi Wright. She runs a company called Wright Social, and she's really focused on the ag space, on rural businesses and farmers who are, you know, trying to reach, I guess, the widest and most relevant audience through social channels. And we've been working with them on how we sort of communicate what we need to various places, and I find that whole space, and you're in it, so you know, in the world of podcasts, you know, all of the weird and wonderful things that go on in the background that optimize and create access and give you the best outcomes. And I think a yarn with her would be really fascinating for some people to learn how they could use social media to either, you know, further their cause if they've got their own brand or their own thing they're trying to get out there, but also how they interact with social media and how that affects what their experience is on social media. So how they kind of, you get back on social media what you engage with or what you kind of put out. So I just reckon that'd be a bit of an out of the box one for your listeners to kind of have a bit of an insight into that world for sure.
Great one, mate. And also, for anyone that wants to reach out to yourself, how can we do so at Gundagai Lamb?
So we're all the socials, so, you know, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, we're just there as Gundagai Lamb.
Yep.
I think probably the other way on our website. So if you go to gundagailamb.com.au, there's a form to fill out that comes immediately to the team, and we usually sort of pick up the phone in the next 24 hours and get in touch with producers if they're curious. And we're always running events on, like tomorrow we've got a producer event all day where we're giving them a plant tour, talking about the tech and innovation and talking about animal health improvements and that sort of stuff. So certainly get in touch through any of those channels and we'd have a conversation about how we might be able to work together.
Beautiful. No worries. Thanks for coming on. We'll talk soon.
Thanks for tuning in to a Farms Advice episode. Go to farmsadvice.com.au for more information and spread the word. If you love this episode, give it a sneaky 5-star review on Apple Podcasts so we can reach more farmers right across Australia. But until then, next Tuesday, keep on farming.